Bank will always fight for their rights.
Palestinian resistance groups have been holding military maneuvers following the Sword of Al-Quds battle to confront any new Israeli war amid the increasing warmongering rhetoric by the Israeli regime.
Observers say that Palestinian resistance groups fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime last year, forcing Tel Aviv to declare a unilateral ceasefire. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
French cement giant Lafarge has lost their final appeal and will undergo a high-profile trial in a precedent-setting case which could force Western corporations to stop turning a blind eye to terrorism. Lafarge will be tried for complicity in crimes against humanity in Syria. They are accused of working with Daesh terrorist group for years in northern Syria, with the concrete produced in their factory used in battlefield infrastructure, which terrorists needed to keep the unrest going. They will be tried for financing terrorism, for allegedly paying 13 million euros to terrorist groups from 2010 to 2014, supposedly to keep their factory safe. They will also be charged for endangering the lives of others, for putting its 11 Syrian employees at risk. The original suit was brought by French NGO Sherpa on behalf of the workers.
We were surprised by the decision of the Court de Cassation. And this decision is really a victory because we were a bit worried that crimes against humanity would be dropped. But the fact also that on top of that, there is the endangering life of workers that has been maintained is really, I mean, a double victory. So we are super happy, even though we have to remember that it's been 6 years.
After the scandal broke, Lafarge was merged with Swiss giant Holcim, but 8 Lafarge executives will now face justice.
It's the first time that a court decided on crimes against humanity, the first time it's on the mother company for the activities of its subsidiary, especially a subsidiary abroad and foreign workers. It's super interesting for access to justice for victims around the globe. And maybe opening, you know, new avenues for the victims of globalization around the world.
Leaked testimony from the Lafarge executives reveals that the French Foreign Ministry knew the entire time, telling Lafarge to hold on and that everything would work out. The case will likely drag on for years, but longtime political heavyweight and former foreign minister Laurent Fabius may be called on to testify. In 2012, he infamously said that al-Nusra, al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, was, quote, doing good things on the ground, and likely with Lafarge's concrete. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
The drama theater of Mariupol. It is the scene of the alleged single most deadly war crime so far in this brutal conflict. Depending on who you believe, it was either a Russian airstrike or done by the Ukrainians to blame it on Russia. The words children are still scrawled on the pavement outside, written in order to ward off a Russian strike.
I talked to emergency workers a week ago. Our fire brigade is over there, and they told me they found 2 more dead bodies.
He breaks down and walks away, unnecessarily ashamed of his tears.
I lost everything. What is left for me here? I have worked here all my life.
This is the second time that I've been here in the last few days. Since the last time, there's a little bit more rubble being cleared up. Interestingly, you can just walk straight in, even though it's a crime scene or a former crime scene, and still a site where it's still pretty dangerous in places. But you can walk straight in. It's that easy. But finding out just what happened here is a little harder.
At the very least, I wanted to find out just how many people had died here. Estimates range from around 30 to over 600. A workman took me down to the basement, but told me his team had only recovered 3 bodies from the rubble. He also grumbled that they could have worked much faster if they hadn't been ordered to remove brick by brick, due to, as he called them, fake stories about hundreds underneath. Some eyewitnesses and previous media reports say that there were over 100 outside the theatre at a field kitchen. None survived, they said. This is Alexander. He says he was sheltering in a basement nearby and came to the theatre the morning after the explosion.
We thought there would be between 500 to 1,000 dead. There are 3 floors, but only 20 bodies were dug out, which means the others were led out from the theatre. Outside, beside the kitchen, There were 15 bodies, thank God.
Witnesses say there was 100 people outside at a food shelter, and they were all killed. Is that what you saw?
No, they only found 20 inside the basement and 15 outside. That's all. We thought that there were 1,000 dead, and we were going around these ruins shouting if there was anyone alive still. There were arms and legs. It's difficult to put it into words.
Alexander also finds it hard to hold back the tears. If this was a Russian strike, it would still constitute a war crime. But have the figures been exaggerated to cause greater uproar?
There is a famous Russian journalist and TV personality. I've spoken to them. They are unsurprisingly very clear that this was a Ukrainian strike to blame on the Russians. But there isn't just a battle on the ground here in Ukraine. There's also a propaganda war as Russia seeks to justify its invasion, and NATO and Ukraine seek to make Russia out to be committing heinous war crimes.
At the nearest hospital, I speak to a medic who was working at the time of the explosion.
Maybe it was a strike from the air. According to another account, it was mined and detonated. I cannot say for sure. It's not clear.
Why couldn't you get to the theater as an ambulance driver?
At that time, the Russian military didn't let us go to the theater. There were battles going on nearby.
If Alexander's testimony is to be believed, and if the workmen are correct about there being few bodies in the rubble, then did the Russians take away hundreds of bodies in the hours after the explosion, in which they took control of the area and before the morning? Possibly. In an honest world, an independent investigation would be carried out to find out what happened and how many people died. But for now, as the war continues to rage, that seems unlikely. As they say, history is written by the winners. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
The UK, home to some of the richest people on the planet. The capital, London, alone, has more billionaires than any other city in the world. That's all according to UK Daily, the Sunday Times Rich List. In this country, it says 250 people now own a combined $886 billion, enough to lift millions out of extreme poverty several times over.
It clearly shows that the capitalist system is not working, and obviously we are celebrating that there are so many more millionaires who have more than doubled or tripled their wealth in the last 2 years, while the poor have become really even poorer.
Many of the names on the list have been there for years. This year, though, two new faces. Chancellor Rishi Sunak, the man in charge of helping millions of struggling British families through the spiraling cost of living crisis, and his wife.
Evidently, someone of his wealth has no understanding of the crisis that a majority of the people are facing. We have 4 million people going to food banks, and the crisis, the cost of living crisis, is becoming very significant. By the end of the year, the ordinary people, the poorer sections of the community, may be even in more difficulty, while Mr. Rishi Sunak is laughing all the way to the bank.
The bulk of Rishi Sunak's wealth stems from his wife, the daughter of an Indian IT mogul. He also made his fortune working for Goldman Sachs and as a hedge fund manager in the past. We wanted to know how Britons felt about their chancellor now being one of the 250 wealthiest people in the country amidst the cost of living crisis that's pushing millions of people into poverty.
I believe it's not fair, particularly the way we found out suddenly. Out of the blue.
I don't feel particular resentment at people who have money, as long as they do their job and do their job well. No one would have known had not it been highlighted recently.
First published in 1989, the Sunday Times Rich List bears the names of 1,000 ultra-rich people or families resident in the United Kingdom. 90% of those on the list are usually men.
At a time of record inflation, when many are struggling with energy bills, petrol prices and food costs, this golden era for the UK's super rich, among them now a government official, does not seem to be coming to an end. Saeed Purizep, London.
U.S. President Joe Biden met South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol for summit talks in Seoul Saturday. The conservative Yoon seeks to strengthen the U.S.-South Korea alliance. Biden's remarks perhaps fell short of the strategic nuclear umbrella the hawkish Yoon seeks, while offering some reassurance regarding North Korea's missile and nuclear programs.
Today, President Yoon and I committed to strengthening our close engagement and work together to take on challenges of regional security, including addressing the threat posed by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, by further strengthening our deterrence posture and working toward a complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
Several demonstrations took place throughout the day outside the summit venue. Peace activists worry Yoon's hasty actions to embrace Washington endanger regional peace and security.
Strengthening the U.S.-South Korea alliance will likely cause a backlash from North Korea, China, and Russia and destabilize the security of South Korea. If we jump on the U.S. strategy too easily, will this really protect the economy and security of South Korea?
Presidents Yoon and Biden also toured a Samsung Electronics factory. Biden plans to launch the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework in Tokyo next week as the U.S. implements the new trade grouping largely aimed at containing China. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol is just 10 days into his five-year term in office. Through this summit with U.S. President Joe Biden, Seoul has now strongly pivoted to a more pro-American foreign policy. The question then is how U.S. adversaries in the region, China and North Korea, will react. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Outrage has spread across the pro-Palestine community this week after British Home Secretary Priti Patel branded the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement racist and anti-Semitic. The controversial comments were issued on Monday at a Conservative Friends of Israel lobby group event.
The BDS movement, everything we have seen around the BDS movement is racist. The anti-Semitic troops, the cartoons, the chants.
Founded in 2005, the BDS movement is a Palestinian-led campaign promoting boycott and economic sanctions against Israel. After a notable rise in popularity and success in recent years, the British establishment has acted to essentially criminalise the practice. In response to Patel's comments, onlookers have pointed out her own policies and praise of Israel's ambassador as blatant hypocrisy.
The hypocrisy of Priti Patel calling anyone or anything racist on one hand, whilst openly gushing for Tzipi Hotovli on the other. I mean, Tzipi is an out-and-out anti-Arab racist. She thinks that Jews and Arabs should have no relationships at all. She also thinks that the Nakba, the expulsion of 700,000 Palestinians at the birth of Israel, she thinks that was a myth. Secondly, Priti Patel herself, her comments against Black Lives Matter, against English footballers who took the knee against in solidarity against racism, and also the laws that she's brought into place, like the Nationality and Borders Act. These comments, these laws, they've further, deeper structuralized racism into British society.
In addition to the anti-BDS remarks, Patel laid bare her so-called unflinching support to Israel. This comes just days after the shock killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhila by Israeli regime forces, making it appear that no matter what crimes are being committed, Tel Aviv can rely on unwavering support from the British Home Office. Robert Carter, London.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
President Biden has announced that the U.S. would respond militarily if China attacked Taiwan. China said in response that no country should underestimate its firm resolve and strong ability to protect its sovereign and territorial interests. Beijing also urged Washington to stop saying or doing things in violation of the One China principle. China has also threatened those who play with fire will certainly burn themselves. The United States and China are already at odds over a myriad of issues as regards technology, trade, Hong Kong, and South China Sea. Now, what about Taiwan? Are the two powers heading for a collision over Taiwan? Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let me introduce our guests in tonight's episode of the Spotlight. We'll have retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel and former Pentagon analyst Karen Kwiatkowski from Mount Jackson, Virginia. Also, the spokesman of the LaRouche organization, Harley Schlanger, joining us from Potsdam, Germany.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show. Let's begin with Karen. Good to have you with us. So, American war planners had previously left the question of U.S. defending Taiwan against Chinese aggression unanswered. But now you have President Biden openly saying that his country will take military action in that case. So, does he really mean it? What has changed?
It's hard to say if he means it or not. I think, actually, the president does mean it. He imagines himself to be a king, I think. I don't think he reads the small print. I don't think he understands the agreements. He is a person who likes to use threatening language, and he uses it.
Mm-hmm. And then we have this state-run Chinese newspaper, The Global Time, saying that Biden's remarks are not gaffes but dangerous signals that the U.S. intends to drop support of the One China policy. So how do you see the future relations between Washington and Beijing?
The current relations aren't as good as they should be, and the future relations could very well get worse. And I think part of what Biden is indicating and why his staff is allowing him to indicate these things is to actually create a kind of ambiguity beyond the normal support of One China policy, but an ambiguity on the use of military force. And the question was asked of the president this time. This is the third time in 9 months that he has made such a statement about coming to the full defense of Taiwan. And all three times the staff has walked him back from that. But this question recently was in context of the Ukrainian defense, the $40 billion that were just the United States Congress just gave to or voted to give to Ukraine, and also the $20 billion before that, it has already been committed to Ukraine. So this is a large military response, and that's what Biden is imagining that he would do in a case of Taiwan. I think in his mind, he would do that.
Okay. Now, Harley is also joining us from Germany. Harley, good to have you with us. So this state-owned paper, The Global Times in China, is saying that China-U.S. relationship is like Titanic, and it's heading for an iceberg. I wonder if you agree with that.
Oh, absolutely. And it's almost entirely the fault of the war party in the United States. We've seen an escalation of rhetoric regarding Russia in Ukraine, and now we're seeing the same thing in China. The intention after the withdrawal from Afghanistan was to carry out a pivot to Asia, which includes the Quad, which includes the idea of an Asian NATO, which included the AUKUS agreement, the Australia-UK-US nuclear sub-agreement. You have Admiral Richard, the chairman of STRATCOM, saying that the U.S. is now more likely to use nuclear weapons than it had been in the past. There's an illusion that exists within the top advisors around Biden, which is that U.S. military power is invincible. And I think they actually are working on war plans for limited nuclear war, preemptive strikes with Russia and China. And in our view, it's completely insane. But it is this view of the unipolar world that the U.S. can dictate with its NATO allies, who really don't bring much to the table except for the British, who actually are part of the crafting of these plans.
Mm-hmm. Harley, we had this reporter asking President Biden that the U.S. did not get involved in Ukraine militarily. What if Taiwan is attacked? And then Biden says, yes, the U.S. would take military action in that case. Now, this is while on his recent Asian trip, he signed agreements with a dozen countries to join the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. So doesn't this send some kind of mixed signals? I mean, speaking of war, at the same time clinching trade deals in Asia, what's Washington's agenda in Asia?
Well, first of all, no deals were actually signed. There are no agreements. It was an agreement to reach an agreement, the so-called Indo-Pacific agreement. A number of the Asian nations are hesitant because they're watching what the U.S. is doing in Ukraine, where, look, I would say the U.S. is virtually a co-belligerent. The weapons that are being delivered have made a bit of a difference to help Ukraine, but more importantly, they're trying to bleed Russia. I think the same intention exists with China, but you have to realize the issue of trade is a phony issue. If the U.S. wanted more trade in Asia, it could join the Belt and Road Initiative. It's been invited to do that. Mm-hmm. What it's trying to do is contain China and stop China's aggressive commitment to infrastructure and development. And that's because the whole Western financial system depends on cheap labor and cheap raw resources from the poorer countries of the world.
All right. Let's turn to Harley now. Harley, I want you to answer the same question, please. It's an important one. Let our viewers know your opinion about what Washington's true intention is and what's the plan for Asia.
Well, the plan is to stop China. The intention is to make sure that you can continue favorable trade agreements for the United States, in other words, for global corporations from the United States, to get cheap labor agreements, to get a supply chain from poorer Asian countries. But the Chinese, which used to do that, have changed. And that's a significant change. Now, the second significant change is the China-Russia agreement. The fact that China and Russia are agreeing not just on military, but on economic policy. You know, one of the important things, and I know many people in Iran know this, one of the important aspects shaping Western policy is the idea of preventing an alliance between Eurasian economic development and Europe. And this is what the Ukraine situation is about, and this is what the China situation is about. Mm-hmm. This goes back to British geopolitics and Mackinder in 1904, and the fact that Russia and China are integrating Eurasia with Eastern Europe, or Russia, and that this is very attractive to people in Germany who otherwise are suffering under the sanctions policy. If Germany were to join with Russia and China, it would be game over for the City of London and Wall Street to be able to dictate economic terms globally.
Okay, Karen, you know that Washington has a close relationship with Taiwan, but officially it pursues, the one China policy, and President Biden also confirmed this. Now, there is no official ties between the U.S. and Taiwan, but Washington sells weapons to Taiwan. It has, great trade relations with it. Is this not contradictory to the one China principle that Washington is saying that it's sticking with?
It is. It is somewhat contradictory, but you know, there's money to be made in Taiwan, and it certainly serves an American purpose to irritate China in that regard. I wanted to agree with what Farley said and add one thing to it as far as the nuclear threat. Biden, after this, went to South Korea and renewed a statement of shared defense, and for the first time ever used the word nuclear in his range of weapons that we've used to defend South Korea. So this idea that nuclear war is being planned for is well documented. Of course, the Pentagon has published documents. RAND Corporation has published documents on the winnability of a nuclear war. But this is clearly something that is out there. Biden is talking about it. He is hinting at it. And I think we have to take him seriously. I am concerned, of course, that Washington is willing to blow up the entire world to destroy it, to achieve its aims.
Mm-hmm. And Karen, let's also talk a little bit about the so-called Quad Group, the U.S., Japan, Australia, and India. And, you know, this has kind of alarmed Beijing. What's the plan?
I think, you know, the world is changing. We've got the multipolar power sharing future, which the United States is unwilling to really cope with. We're not going to tolerate that, or Washington, D.C. is not going to. So much of what passes for our foreign policy is really a war against a multipolar world, which cannot be stopped. It's already well down the road, not just with military cooperation, economic cooperation, but also financial cooperation, which we're seeing right now in with China and Russia and many of the other countries in dealing with U.S. sanctions.
Mm-hmm. Chinese President Xi Jinping has said that reunification between China and Taiwan is inevitable, and he refused to rule out the use of force. So what's the prospect like for the two countries?
Well, I think the Chinese do not want to have a war over Taiwan. There were significant developments of improved trade relations, economic investment in Taiwan from China, mutual cooperation in artificial intelligence and other areas. But this, as Karen was saying, this irritates Washington, which seems to believe that all trade must flow from Washington and London, or from Wall Street and London. And the fact that China has become a major economic power is the real problem, because the unipolar world, which people in Washington swear loyalty to, is based on the idea that no other country can dictate terms of trade. And the idea of the Great Reset is an intention of putting all the power in the hands of central banks, which really represent private banks and private corporate cartels. And the idea that China can work with poorer countries, as in Africa, in South Asia, even in Latin America, in the Caribbean nations are opening ties with China, and the State Department is going crazy over this. So It really is the emergence of a multipolar world. It's unstoppable. The only thing they can do is blow it up. And I think that's why you're seeing a reaction, which I think from Washington is seen in many capitals as panic over losing the unipolar world, and over the fact that with inflation, with supply chain problems and other things, the Western economies are in terrible shape.
Mm-hmm. Now let me put the same question to Karen. Karen, what do you see on the horizon for China and Taiwan? Would there be a war, or would there be reunification at any price, like President Xi Jinping is saying?
I don't see reunification. I agree with Harley. I think between those two are to come together to have trade. Even as China, despite some of the things we've seen with the COVID-19 response, even China is in some ways listening to its people more, that kind of thing. Being a more integrated democracy, it's not a democracy, but they listen to their people. So it's not even the stereotypical dictatorship or communist state anymore. That doesn't exist over there in that regard. So I think a peaceful coming together and a profitable coming together is down the road, but I think it'll take a lot of time. You're talking, honestly, generational. If you don't do it via war, you have to do it when the culture itself changes, and I think that culture is changing, and it's going to take time, and I'm sure the Chinese are willing to wait for that.
Mm-hmm. And Harley, China and Russia conducted joint military drills today. It lasted 13 hours. Of course, they're saying that this is routine practice. So what signal does that send to Washington and its allies in Asia?
Well, you know, I was talking to some people around the Pentagon recently, And they acknowledged that their whole plan for military confrontation was always based on the idea of either war with Russia or war with China, but not a two-front war. And this, of course, blows everything out of the water for them, because the idea that, that the United States would have to carry out operations in the Pacific and with Russia, it doesn't work. I mean, the United States had trouble maintaining forces and control in Afghanistan. So I think the problem that people in Washington have is that they tend to see things as military first. The February 4th meeting between Putin and Xi Jinping was primarily about economic integration, a coordination. And the military was secondary, but they knew that if they came closer together economically, it would provoke a reaction from the U.S. and NATO against them. And so of necessity, they have to be prepared militarily. But it's also clear that Washington's policies are driving much of the rest of the world into a distrust of the dollar and the U.S. You know, the U.S. just stole $30 billion from Russia. China is trying to figure out how to pull some of its investments in the United States out before it faces the same kind of problem. So in all of this, Washington is the problem. And I think unless something changes dramatically, and of course you have a bipartisan consensus on these policies in Washington, we may be in it for a long, long war.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of the show. Let me thank our guests. We had retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel and former Pentagon analyst Karen Kwiatkowski from Mount Jackson, Virginia. Also spokesman of the LaRouche organization, Harley Schlanger, joined us from Potsdam, Germany. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time. We'll be right back.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
There are longer-term solutions to solving the world's ongoing refugee crises, such as addressing the root causes that endanger people's lives and livelihoods. But a fundamental principle of any morally functioning government is to uphold the human rights of people to seek safety, and not shift that responsibility to states with less developed asylum systems. Here we present you an article in this regard, written by Joshua Surtees, a journalist and former writer for UNHCR, under the heading, "Rich Britain Sending Refugees to Rwanda Isn't Burden Sharing. It's Shameful Exploitation." Please stay with us to hear more about the story. Joshua Surtees wrote, "In my time working for the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, a stark fact was often mentioned. The vast majority of the world's displaced people are hosted by the world's poorest countries. Today, 85% of the refugees live in developing countries, while the richest nations host just 15%. While Rwanda might be developing economically, it is still among the world's 25 poorest countries. The UK is among the world's 10 richest countries. To acknowledge the disparity of wealth between the two nations and decide that Rwanda is better able to accommodate people attempting the treacherous journey across the channel takes a huge leap of the imagination." The deal announced by UK Home Secretary Priti Patel in Kigali on Thursday, April 14th, demonstrates the government's tenacious commitment to positioning Britain as a country that is close to the world and to those who need its sanctuary the most. There has been a great deal of political debate and condemnation since the policy was announced, and the government arranged for the arrival in Rwanda of the British media it thought best placed to help it trumpet this maneuver in time for the local elections. But there are still questions we must ask to ascertain whether this is a cynical ploy or a thought-through policy. Joshua Surtee said, "Is it because Rwanda has more geographic capacity, perhaps? More free land or housing infrastructure? Is Britain really bursting at the seams? Rwanda's population density is almost double that of Britain's. It is a country almost twice as crowded as ours, yet per capita, it already hosts five times as many refugees as the UK, as well as hosting Congolese and Burundian refugees. Rwanda has recently offered itself as a host country for the emergency evacuation of refugees trapped in dire conditions in Libya." In the introduction to the Home Office's Memorandum of Understanding with Rwanda, the UK boasts of having taken in 25,000 Syrian refugees as a way of demonstrating its long, proud history of providing protection to those who need it. This claim is laughable. More than 6 million Syrians have fled their country in the 11 years since war began. For much of the crisis, Lebanon hosted 2 million Syrians, representing a third of Lebanon's 6 million population. Bangladesh, one of the world's most densely populated countries, hosts close to 1 million Rohingya refugees from Myanmar. Poland is currently hosting 2.7 million Ukrainians. These figures put in context what it really means to protect those in need. The memorandum speaks of burden sharing during refugee crises. Rwanda, a country that has experienced its fair share of crises, is already shouldering its share of the burden. The UK comfortably has the capacity to take in people crossing the channel. It is neglecting its share of the burden while persuading Rwanda to carry more. How the Home Secretary managed to convince the Rwandan government to accept this arrangement may become apparent in due course. When Australia utilized the tiny island state of Nauru for a similar purpose, it gave aid in return. Australia, an immensely privileged country, effectively paid a less economically fortunate country to take desperate people off its hands, in some cases for years. The British government is callously copying the Australian playbook. While its PR agents in the press trumpet this coup as some kind of triumph, the Daily Mail's front page read, "Rwanda plan to smash the Channel gangs." The Daily Express said, "Bold plan to send both migrants to Rwanda." As though the Prime Minister had overseen a selfless act of reason, humanity, bravery, striking a blow for compassion, saving England from the scourge of people simply trying to escape death and poverty. When Boris Johnson referred in his speech on Thursday, April 14th, to people illegally entering the country, he was using the worst kind of semantics. Refugees fleeing the conflicts or persecution do not have the luxury of entering Britain legally. If they had the time and opportunity to apply for a UK visa, they would not, in essence, be refugees. Seeking asylum routinely involves entering a territory without prior permission. When UNHCR's Asia and Pacific Director, Enrica Ratawat, visited Nauru in 2018, he reported his shock at the immense toll that long-term detention had taken on people's mental health. Over 80% had been diagnosed with PTSD, trauma, and depression. He told the press the sense of hopelessness and despair was extremely tangible. In Greece, in 2020, asylum seekers living at Moria Reception Center on the island of Lesbos burnt it down in what was perceived by many as a protest at the poor conditions and dangerous levels of overcrowding. We should not automatically assume that Rwanda's model of hosting asylum seekers will follow that of Lesbos of Nauru. Indeed, there are some good news stories about refugee integration there. But Rwanda, which Johnson describes as one of the world's safest countries, is also a country that cannot provide an acceptable life conditions for its citizens because it is one of the world's poorest countries. What guarantees can we have that non-citizens will be well received? Rwanda has internal transit centers where people deemed undesirable, including beggars, are sent in order to keep the streets looking appealing for tourists attracted by the country's international marketing campaigns. Rwandans who oppose or criticize the government are liable to be informed on by neighbors, placed under surveillance, blackmailed, tortured, sent to rehabilitation camps, or even killed. Many Rwandans were forcibly returned to the country from refugee camps in neighboring countries in the years after the 1994 genocide. Many continue to risk their lives or liberty to trek through remote jungles to escape and flee to Uganda as refugees themselves. In reporting Patel and Johnson's plan, the Daily Telegraph said that migrants will be encouraged to settle in Rwanda. The agreement doesn't appear to give them much choice in the matter. Their options, should Rwanda not turn out to be a safe or sustainable place for them, will be somewhat limited. The memorandum says Rwanda will ensure that it will treat each relocated individual and process their claim for asylum in accordance with the Refugee Convention. But what about the UK's obligations to abide by the convention that it is a signatory to? What about that claimed long and proud history of protection? UNHCR, the organization designed to uphold the convention, has said it will delay its judgment on the legality of Patel's deal until its legal teams in Geneva have analyzed the details. Though, its position is clear. It said in a statement, UNHCR does not support the outsourcing of asylum states' obligations. There are longer-term solutions to solving the world's ongoing refugee crisis, such as addressing the root causes that endanger people's lives and livelihoods. But a fundamental principle of any morally functioning government is to uphold the human rights of people to seek safety, and not shift that responsibility to states with less developed asylum systems.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.